This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom and who have endured some pretty remarkable things in that pursuit. And each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. The goal is to honor them for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired by these stories. And we're going to hear one today from a guy who's pretty young, 96 years young, going to be 97 in May, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but for the last 35 years a resident of Las Vegas, Nevada. And that's where we are today with Alan Dunbar, Purple Heart recipient, ex-prisoner of war, and longtime VA employee. But let's talk before any of that happened. Growing up in Philadelphia, what was your life like as a young boy? Were you rooting on the Phillies or the A's, the Athletics, or what?
Oh, I was an athletic fan. I was a baseball fan because I played baseball in high school. I was a good field, no hit.
Mm-hmm. Join the club.
But I I was a catcher. We had on the baseball team a screwball pitcher.
Ooh.
And he was a left-hander, and I was the only guy that could catch him. And he broke my little finger on my right hand three times.
Ouch. And that didn't help with the hitting either, I'm sure.
No, I was a good field, no hit. But I enjoyed the game, and it was more of an enjoyment for me that they even let me on the ball team. But this pitcher, he not only was a screwball pitcher, he was a screwball.
Kept you on your toes, huh?
Yeah.
And what high school was that?
West Philadelphia High School.
West Philadelphia High School. Were you a big Connie Mack fan? Did you go see those games?
I went to the athletic games. I was a fan of Connie Mack. I liked the way he waved his card as he sat in the dugout. And when he waved his card, the infielders and the outfielders would go to the position where he waved the card. And I'd be sitting in the stands with either my father or one of my brothers. You'd see him wave that card, and then Max Bishop, who was his second baseman, he'd move over where the manager told him to stand, and the next thing you know, the opposing batter would hit the ball right to Max. Mm-hmm. If he'd been to the other place, he would have got a single or a double. Connie Mack was the manager of the Philadelphia Athletics when baseball was baseball.
What are you saying it is now?
Too much money being passed around.
Amen. I've got to ask you, since you're such a baseball guy, who is the most amazing player that you ever saw in person there?
Lefty Grove.
Yeah.
When he came out to pitch, the fans stood up and clapped and clapped and clapped. Then they sat down and they watched this man go through his magic of pitching left-handed to the opposing team, and they were striking out 1, 2, 3. In the games that I saw, they were hitting the balls to the infielders. The outfielders, one of them even sat down for the inning.
I thought that only happened in Little League, not the American League.
Yeah, but Lefty Grove went out to him, and he stood up for the rest of the game.
So you finished West Philadelphia High School. You went to Temple University and graduated in 1940. What'd you get your degree in?
Transportation and traffic law. I tried to get a job in New York because that's where the major transportation people conduct their business. And it was impossible because I had a low number in the draft and nobody would hire me. And I couldn't blame him. So I went back and I told my father that I struck out. Well, he says, I think you ought to go to work until you're drafted. And I said, I agree, Dad. Well, he says, I'm a personal friend of the director of training or down there in Philadelphia refinery. He says, I can get the job down there. They're going to call you a sample chaser. I said, what's a sample chaser? He told me, he says, you know those large tanks you see in the field? You have to walk up iron steps to the top. Well, you carry a thing that has six bottles, like Coca-Cola bottles. You have to drop them down with a weight till it fills up, cork it, you label it where you got it from, what it is, and you stick it back. And then when you get a full case of six, you go back to the lab and test it for viscosity and all that business. So that's what I did.
Until the Army was ready for you.
Until the Army sent me a notice, dear Mr. Dunbar, your number has come up in the draft.
How'd you feel about that?
Well,
because the war wasn't going yet.
No, I didn't like being a private. The sergeant says, oh, a draftee, we'll take care of this guy. They're from the south and I'm from the north.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day we were out in a field in South Carolina. Major came around and he said, Fort Benning, Georgia is an infantry training camp. He says, you go down there for 3 months, and if you pass, you'll become a second lieutenant. So I went to OCS.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1941, I got a commission, and lo and behold, the Army's thinking, they sent me back to the same unit I was a private in. And the sergeant says, look, who the hell's got a second lieutenant's commission? And he left here as a private. And I says, isn't that a lucky thing for me? I didn't take it out on him. I thought better of it. And I learned a lot about what the Army did and why we had to fight the enemy. Kill them. You can't be a mealy mouth being a second lieutenant. Aim your pistol at somebody and pull the trigger and he doesn't walk away. So we were trained to kill.
But you didn't know who the enemy was yet.
We didn't.
But you'd find out pretty soon.
Oh, we found out pretty soon when I got transferred to the 29th Division and I was sent there as a communications officer.
So is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
That's where I was.
What do you remember about that day? Because everybody seems to remember something about where he was and how he found out the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Well, this is the thing that bothered me. During when I was a child, my father took us to Japan. They were not our enemies then.
No.
They were our friends. I learned some Japanese words. I was a youngster then. But my father said when we came back to Pennsylvania, something strange. He said to me, Alan, I took you to Japan and the rest of your brothers because someday, this is my father speaking, someday we may be fighting the Japanese because they're interested in a global affair.
Wow.
With the United States. Now, I learned this from men who are knowledgeable about the Japanese history. So you may be fighting them someday, so don't make friends with anybody in Japan.
Wow. And how old were you?
9.
So this is the late 20s.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your brothers a couple times. How many brothers did you have?
2. They both went to the University of Pennsylvania. Oldest brother went on to become a doctor. And he went with the 3rd Marine Division over in Japan.
Yeah.
So some of the people that he was fighting against, the Japanese, were friends of his because he went with my father at the time. So he wrote to my father, and he says, what shall I do, Dad? He says, you are the oldest son. Use your better judgment.
Hmm.
If for some reason you see a friend of yours when you were a youngster, use your better judgment. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Hmm.
As his younger brother, I said, I wouldn't want that responsibility at all.
Yeah. Well,
Bill. A friend's a friend to me.
And what about your other brother? What did he do during the war?
He was a commander in the Navy. He commanded a ship, a sub chaser. And unfortunately, my brother got killed. His ship was sunk by the Italians. All was lost on the ship. Was attacked by an Italian task force that was going out to the sea, and they happened to be right there by a small town of Italy, and they got caught with their pants down.
In the Mediterranean, then?
Yeah, in the Mediterranean. There were four or five battleships, and there was that a small attack cruiser, and the thing went down, and everybody was lost.
When did you learn of that?
I learned of that when I was training. I said, gee, what is Mom going to do? Her oldest son, he's a doctor. He commands a hospital. The middle son, his ship went down, and he was engaged to be married. I want to tell you this story because it has to be told. Middle son was engaged to be married to a Catholic girl. He signed over his government life insurance, $10,000 policy on his life, and he was killed. And you know what? She turned it down. She gave it to my mother.
Wow.
When I found out about that, I said to Kathleen, I said, why did you do that, Kathleen? She says, because your mother got nothing from raising a son to be killed in his service. She says, I wanted her to have the $10,000. What is the $10,000 going to do for me when I know that Joe has been killed? Now, I promised your mother, if I got married, our first son, I would name Joseph.
That's pretty amazing. And did she name her son Joseph?
Yes, she did. She sent me a picture of the baby.
Wow.
Well, that's one of those things. But I'll tell you, being a POW was the worst disgrace for me.
Well, I want to hear that story, and I'm just thinking about as you talk about your brother giving his life in the service of our country, that you came a lot closer than I'm sure you would have wanted to doing the same thing. But let's get you to that point. So you end up in the 106th Infantry Division?
Yes, I did.
And what was your duty?
I was the communications officer of the 422nd Infantry Regiment.
So what did that mean? What did a communications officer have to do?
Well, the communications officer was responsible for the communications of the entire regiment. From all the companies, I was responsible for laying the wires from the command headquarters of Colonel Deschenaux was the regimental commander. I had to make sure that my men laid wires to the 1st, the 2nd, and the 3rd Battalion of the 422nd Infantry so they would have communications with the regimental commander. When he got orders from the division commander, he had to get his main radio operator, send a message to every battalion commander with the order of battle. So that was my responsibility. And here I'm up at division headquarters. I'm up the tree.
You're taking me right to December of 44 now, as you're
taking you to December of 44.
So this is the Battle of the Bulge has just started.
The Battle of the Bulge started, and the old man, it's an affectionate term, the old man is the regimental commander.
Right.
He's younger than I am. But he's the old man.
Well, you were a pretty old man, relatively speaking, at 26 at the time, compared to a lot of the guys around you, I'm sure.
They were all young.
Yep.
I had 18 and 19-year-old kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had one man, his name was Canoy. He had two left feet. He was my radio operator. He could take 28 words a minute.
Wow.
Damn good. And the colonel said to me, he says, but he can't shoot. He's an infantry soldier first, and he can't shoot. He can't hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sir, it's not the question that he can't shoot, but he takes 28 words a minute. I am not going to get rid of them, sir. The regimental commander looks at me and he says, Alan, you're going to have the dumbest radio operator in your platoon. I said, sir, he may not be a good soldier. He doesn't have to be a good soldier for me. If he can take 28 words a minute, he can get radio calls from everybody. The whole division, there's nobody takes 28 words a minute. So he says, he can't even run the obstacle course. I said, sir, will you do me a favor? He says, anything, Alan. I says, if I get Kanoi to get over that 8-foot wall, will you get off my back? So he says, I'll do it if he gets over the wall. And I won't even mention his name again. I said, is that a promise, Colonel? He says, Alan, between you and I, that is a promise. And I won't tell anybody else.
All right.
I got him over the wall.
How'd you pull that off?
I said, Kanoi, I want you to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. There'll be nobody out here except you and me. So we met out on the obstacle course. I said, you stand here. When I yell at you, go, you run as fast as you can. And I'm going to be at the bottom of that wall with my hands cupped, and I'm going to throw you over the wall. He says, you're out of your mind. That's what he tells me. I said, try it. And he's way down there, and I yell at him, ready? Yes, sir. Go. He's running fast. He's only about 4'8", right? He's a little guy. And I says, you see my hands cupped? Hit with your left foot. So he went, and hey, boy, he went right on my feet, and I threw him over the wall, and I passed him.
The colonel didn't read the fine print on that promise, I guess, huh?
No.
He didn't say he couldn't have any help.
We need to catch our first commercial break, but remember that name, Kanoi, because it's going to come up again at the end of the show. You don't want to miss that. When we come back, we'll learn how Mr. Dunbar was wounded and captured on the same day, December 19th, 1944, the Battle of the Bulge. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.